chocolate, yogurts and stuff, so they can have a full meal. Like, everything I have, it's all for them. So, you know, it is difficult.
Independent Charity provides aid to 800 food bank users. And with the UK's economic downturn making the poor even poorer, they're warning more people will be knocking on their doors.
According to the government's new budget, benefits will be increasing in line with inflation, but that's not until April. So that means our guests will continue to struggle throughout the winter for the next few months, throughout the rain and snow and cold weather.
Food banks are now at breaking point due to a tsunami of need driven by the cost of living crisis.
Regular donors are unable to donate what they used to. Funders have less money to give to support because of all of that was spent during the pandemic. So while our demand is still the same, the support that we need to provide it is running out.
Charities estimate more than 2 million people in Britain now depend on food aid. For now, help is around, with those in need hoping the country's economic outlook improves. The question is how long that will take. Saeed Puriza, London.
A conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is dubbed Judaization of Al-Quds and Ways to Confront It. Experts, academics, and senior Palestinian officials have attended the conference. They have discussed ways to tackle the growing Israeli violence against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This, as Israeli officials have been trying to Judaize the holy Muslim city of Al-Quds in the past by demolishing Palestinian homes and building illegal Jewish settlements.
We are holding this conference to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to reaffirm the Islamic identity of Al-Quds. Holding this event this year is of great significance amid the escalation of Zionist aggressions against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state. The Hamas movement asserted the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Quds and refuted all Israeli claims to the holy city.
Al-Quds was never a state or a capital of a state for the Jews. All the history indicated that it was part of Palestine, and Palestine was and still is a part of the Arabic countries, which is a part of the Islamic world.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. Those who attended the conference slammed the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime. In its final communique, the conference stressed the importance of protecting Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots. Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and has been turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's just another attempt to mute the voice of the voiceless. Prost TV managers were not surprised by Eurosat's decision to stop broadcasting the news outlet, as they say this is not the first time Prost TV is being banned in the West.
Well, this gesture by the West is not anything new in terms of Prost TV and even some of its, sister channels. So it puts under the microscope the real intention behind this. So the way this appears to be is that it's part of a bigger picture of this maximum pressure campaign that's been exerted on Iran. I am sure there's some geopolitical interest involved in terms of trying to limit Iran's reach when it comes to the media. But in particular, obviously, another reason for this act by the West, which is really against the pillars that they actually advocate, which is freedom of speech.
Eurosat is a French satellite operator providing coverage over the entire European continent, the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and the Americas. It is the world's third largest satellite operator in terms of revenues. In mid-November, the European Union imposed sanctions on Prost TV over claims that the news network airs forced confessions of detainees in connection with the recent unrest in Iran.
I've been working here at Prost TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Prost TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. And these sanctions on Press TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Press TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
In 2013, Press TV was brought off the air in the UK after media regulator Ofcom revoked its license over alleged breaching of its rules. In the same year, it was taken off the air in North America after the U.S. Treasury Department placed sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Press TV was also dropped from the Galaxy 19 satellite platform that allowed it to be broadcast in the United States and Canada. Press TV has also repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on multiple social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.
It's not the first time, and perhaps not the last time, that the West has attempted to pull the plug on Press TV. However, the news network says it will continue its professional journalism based on its motto of being a voice for the voiceless. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A month after going to the polls, the results of the United States midterms are finally known. The Democratic Party has narrowly won a runoff vote in the state of Georgia, meaning they will retain control of the upper house of Congress, but with a mere 51-49 edge over Republicans.
They've come up with things that are going to help a larger block of people. Conversely, the Republicans are just pushing back and creating exclusionary not even policy, but just exclusionary commentary. So Republicans are going to make all these crazy claims. And I'm not being partisan. I'm just saying that's what they said they're going to do.
However, over the past 2 years, a small faction of right-leaning Democrats was enough to consistently torpedo the legislation of President Joe Biden. Celebrations are further tempered by the fact that Republicans won control of the lower House of Representatives, meaning Congress is now divided.
A divided Congress means that the United States is facing 2 years of political gridlock, with each party voting down the other's legislation, and then capped by an extremely tense presidential election in 2024.
Just like in the years 2000, 2004, 2016, and 2020, there have been widespread complaints about the integrity of the nation's elections. Much of the Democrats' loss can be traced to disillusionment and disinterest from African American and youth voters, whose turnout dropped to an estimated 35% and 27%, respectively.
I would say I'm not hearing too much about it. I'm 19, so I might be part of it. My friends probably aren't just talking about it very much. I think they're probably just too distracted, and they maybe think it doesn't affect them enough for it to matter to them. However, it certainly should, because it can affect them maybe later in life.
Many are now lamenting that the Democrats didn't do enough to win over the average voter during the 2 years they controlled both the White House and Congress, as they remain focused on the era of ex-President Donald Trump instead. Now that they have the subpoena power, Republicans are looking for payback, meaning an even worse era of partisanship will likely be inaugurated on January 3rd. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A Church of England disciplinary tribunal for Reverend Stephen Sizer, one of the leading figures in the debunking of Christian Zionism. The purpose of the tribunal, to hear 11 anti-Semitism accusations against him. His main accuser, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The accusations against him, sharing a platform with Holocaust deniers while attending peace conferences in the Middle East, and sharing on social media articles containing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from other websites. The 68-year-old priest declined to comment after the hearing, but people close to him say he's been crucified for criticizing Israel.
Those Jews like me and many others who worked with Dr. Sizer for many years know for sure that he's the last person on this earth you could call an anti-Semite or racist. He is the kindest, very careful person. and he's anything but the opposite of anti-Semite. He is against what Israel is doing, so am I, and so are many Jews in this country and across the world.
The problem arises from the controversial International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with hatred of Jews.
Now is the time the Church of England really needs to stop on the IHRA. You can't come out and say they have reservations with the IHRA and then still use the same definition. This makes no sense in any shape or form and needs to be addressed seriously. It's basically like saying, we agree that this is wrong, but we're still going to go ahead with it because we don't really care whether it offends Muslims or whether it upsets Muslims.
Today's hearing cleared the Reverend of 7 of the 11 allegations against him.
A final hearing is scheduled for next month. People close to Stephen Sizer say that this whole thing was a witch hunt that has taken its toll on the Reverend, on his family, and the people who support him and the Palestinian cause. Site 4 is up London.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion.
That is why we encourage member states to improve the targeting of this measure, and we have recommended replacing broad-based priced measure with a cost-efficient two-tier energy pricing system.
Out of control, energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States House of Representatives has announced an investigation into allegations of a secret deal to boost oil production between the administration of President Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia. Biden is accused of trying to arrange a deal with Riyadh to increase oil production ahead of the U.S. midterm elections last month. Conservative lawmakers say that could represent election manipulation. It's the first official probe announced since the Republicans won control of the House of Representatives. Many other controversial hearings are expected to follow, such as on the handling of the coronavirus, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, corruption allegations involving Biden's son, and others. Just as Democrats forced questionable investigations over the past 2 years, a now divided Congress will likely be preoccupied with partisan issues of often questionable importance to the average person.
In the end of neoliberalism, we're in a kind of age of disorder. And this is kind of the show that is being played out, is that people are just going to be disillusioned from politics entirely. And that's going to open up the potential of polarization, like wider polarization.
Pro-Trump representatives in the House have already introduced articles of impeachment against Biden over the family-related corruption allegations. Many are skeptical that Congress will devote enough time to meeting the widespread economic problems caused by record inflation and Western belligerence towards Russia, China, Iran, and others.
Now, let's still push through the agenda that's necessary to to maintain the super rich are super rich and that no relief for the working class. And once again, points to the need for the urgency for the foundation for a new party and also ultimately a new system.
An irony is that Riyadh and the OPEC Plus oil production group ultimately ignored Biden's demands for more oil and instead voted to cut production. And despite the cuts, last month Biden still awarded Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity for all cases involving the infamous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Biden campaigned on holding bin Salman accountable, and his backtracking drew global condemnation. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused the West of exploiting Ukraine and using its people as cannon fodder against Russia. Putin said Western states' policies are increasing the risk of a global conflict. Russia has repeatedly denounced the West's military support for Ukraine, saying that Western countries are only adding fuel to the flames of war. Let's begin this edition of Spotlight with a brief introduction of our guests for this program. We have former CIA analyst Ray McGovern joining us from Raleigh. Also founder of transnational.live, Jan Ober, joining us from Lund, Sweden.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. McGovern. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has recently accused the West of not seeking to find a solution to end the Ukraine war. He says the Western countries are exploiting Ukraine and using its people as, quote, cannon fodder. Walk us through these comments, please.
Well, it's been a long time since this has been brewing. And one prominent professor in the United States, John Mearsheimer, has been saying for 8 years now that Putin perceives the NATO advancement in Ukraine and the employment or the deployment of missile holes in already in Romania and going into Poland and maybe, they thought, Ukraine as a direct existential threat that the West is trying to build what Mearsheimer calls a bulwark right on Russia's border in an area that could not be more sensitive if anyone knows about history of the last two centuries. So what Putin is saying here is a battering ram. Well, that's the same as a bulwark, except it's even worse. Now, I will say a few words later, if you wish, about the one ray of hope that I see. But right now, Putin is criticizing more directly than ever before what he calls the Western elites, who still think that the West is predominant, that the West is indispensable, that the West is exceptional to the point where others should obey its diktat.
Sure. Mr. Oberg, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has criticized Western states' policies, as Mr. Govern just mentioned, warning that they're increasing the risk of a global conflict. Now, Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were, in fact, parties to the conflict. The question here is, if this support continues, will it lead to the conflict most likely spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger? Of course, we saw what happened with Poland recently. That surely gave everyone a scare of how easily this thing could escalate.
Let me just say that as a conflict analyst and peace researcher, I make a distinction between the conflict and the violence. And my simple formulation is Russia is responsible for the war, and NATO's expansion and NATO's policies are responsible for the underlying conflict. And if you want to solve a conflict, stop a war, the only thing you can do is to work with the conflict. Who are parties to it? What do they think? What attitudes do they have? What behavior do they have? What can they live with in the future? Now, by staring only, as media and politicians do, on the violence, the war, the arms exports, who is doing what, this whole media warfare thing we have seen since February 24 is a total waste of time. It's a total waste of time. I repeat that. What we should ask ourselves in the East and West, North and South, is what is this conflict about? And Ray has already said much of it. It is about NATO's expansion. And it is that Putin, in his statement in 2007, said, where are all your promises to Gorbachev? You didn't keep them. And in 2021, very late last year, he came up with proposals in which he said very clearly, we accept NATO's expansion, but not when it comes to Ukraine. So the long story short is NATO should never have done what it did. And Mearsheimer is, as Ray also knows, by far not the only one. There are at least 20 leading realpolitik experts who say, don't include Ukraine in your expansion or you will have war. It's ambassadors, American ambassadors to Moscow. It's George Kennan. It was Stephen Cohen. It was myself 6 years ago. It was lots of people who know a little bit about security politics and realpolitik and common security who said, don't do that. And NATO is autistic by this moment. Has been autistic since it went into Ukraine in early 90s. A few months after Ukraine became an independent state, NATO was there and put up its office. And so I used to say, a little jokingly, but I mean it seriously, what we should discuss is NATO's role in Ukraine rather than Ukraine's role in NATO, because that's the key to the history of this conflict.
Okay, Mr. McGovern, Russia has accused Western countries are pursuing, quote, destructive policies by supplying Kiev with weapons and training the Ukrainian military, but negotiations seem to be the only viable solution. You just mentioned you want to talk about that only ray of hope. Maybe this is along those lines. Vladimir Putin believes that the political and financial support that Ukraine's Western allies have given Kiev is the reason that Kiev is completely rejecting any negotiations. Is that one of the reasons why talks are not happening?
Well, the main reason why talks are not happening is because the U.S., who is the prime mover in this struggle, is trying to use Ukraine as, if you will, cannon fodder to weaken Russia. Now, McGovern is not making that up, but that comes out of the mouth of the Defense Secretary of the United States of America. The objective is to weaken Russia. And so Zelensky, newly named man of or person of the year, he hears this from our defense secretary and he says, oh, so that's why my people are being killed thousands each week. So it's about, oh, so we're being used as proxies. Oh, well, Zelensky doesn't say that. Zelensky is a sharp saluting peon, a subordinate of the United States. So what I'm saying here is that Zelensky is between a rock and a hard place. He can't do anything without the approval of the neo-Nazis or, on the other hand, the United States. Now, when I mentioned a glimmer of hope, you know, back in the day, we used to read all the statements of Russian leaders, Soviet leaders. We read them chapter, we memorized them all the way through. Now, when Putin made a major speech, about 45 minutes, at Valdai, but then sat still for three more hours of Q&A, well, I read them, I watched them, and I printed them out, and I read them again, okay? Now, what did I find in the penultimate question? Ooh, a question about Odessa. A question is asked of Putin, I believe it was a canned question. Someone says, I'd like to visit Odessa, maybe next week or maybe in 2 years. Should I apply for a Ukrainian or should I apply for a Russian visa? Cute way to ask that question, huh? Now, Russian forces are fully capable of moving and taking Odessa, Nikolaev, and all the way down to the Romanian border, for God's sake. Will they do it? Here's a hint that they would stop. Putin answers this question, and he says, no, Odessa can be a Yabloka Razdora, Russian for an apple of discord. Those of you who remember Greek mythology, that's how the Trojan War started, for God's sake. So Odessa can be an apple of discord, or, these are Putin's words, or a symbol of conflict resolution, a symbol of finding some kind of solution to everything that is happening now. It's not a question of Russia. We have said many times we are ready to negotiate, but the leaders of the Kiev regime have decided not to continue negotiations. It is true, get this, it is true that the final word belongs to those who implement this policy in Washington. It is very easy for them to solve this problem, to send an appropriate signal to Kiev that they should change their position and seek a peaceful solution to these problems, and that will do it, period.
Okay.
End quote. Now, what does that mean? That means that Putin, in the tradition of Russian and Soviet leaders, is dropping a broad hint. Could be not an apple of discord, but it could be a way through this thing. Did anyone mention that in the U.S. press? No. So what I'm afraid of is that even this pretty clear, however subtle, reminder that there is a way out, all the U.S. has to do is lean on Kiev and say, look, this is it. That's very clear, right. But it was not picked up on. And now I think this latest speech today by Putin indicates that he's about at his wit's end. And I fear for what's going to happen this winter when the ice freezes over and 300,000 Russian troops are ready to march to the West. Will Odessa be taken? I think it's still up for grabs. There still is a negotiation process that could begin by the Russians saying, okay, well, we won't take Odessa, but we require A, B, and C.
Jan Oberg, picking up on the point that Mr. McGovern just said, I want to rewind back to April. Multiple U.S. sources said that Russian and Ukrainian negotiators appeared to have agreed on a peace deal, but the British Prime Minister, then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, prevented that from taking place. Boris Johnson's position was reportedly of that the collective West, which felt Putin was not as strong as they initially thought, and they saw the war as an opportunity to press Putin, taking into account the ripple effects, specifically the energy crisis that Europe is facing. Was this a miscalculation?
Well, I was just about to point to Boris Johnson's frequent visits, because it seems from what you can read in the more or less alternative press, that was exactly his task. It was to tell Zelensky to stop negotiation or to seek a negotiated solution. I remember Zelensky came to the presidency on a ticket of making peace. And I would grant him that much, that that was probably what he wanted at that time. I don't know. But somebody told him, stop that. And I think that's related to Secretary of Defense Austin's and Blinken's visit, in which it was clearly stated, as Ray also pointed out, that we are here to in Ukraine to weaken Russia. Now, the long-term strategy of that, of course, is if in the fantasy world of NATO, which now, by the way, I call a church or a secular religion or militarism, because there's no arguments, no analysis brought on the website of NATO anymore. It's postulations and declarations. I think the long-term strategy is, in this fantasy world, we'll get rid of Russia as an adversary, as something we could call a threat, because in the long run, we are turning against China. So, you know, this is a regional conflict in Europe, but it's much more than that. And had we decided to listen just a bit to somebody else but ourselves in the West, we would have listened to Gorbachev. We would have listened to Olof Palme. We would have listened to all the people who worked, including peace researchers, with a new security structure, a new European house with something like, you know, a United Nations of Europe, talking to each other, a stronger OSCE, a stronger United Nations, a weaker or non-existent NATO, because the Warsaw Pact and the Warsaw Pact and Soviet Union had disappeared. And you can go on like this, and it's all well described in books, in national security archives in the US, etc., that there were lots of alternatives that could have been practiced, but NATO had one policy. We don't listen to others. We expand. We break all the promises. And this is where you are today. I am not thereby saying or endorsing that Russia intervened militarily in Ukraine. I think that has led to the membership of this pressure, this kind of, you know, tit-for-tat membership of Sweden and Finland in NATO. It has led to a horrifying and absolutely disgusting sanctions regime, which even is against international law. We've done all the wrong things in response to Putin's or Russia's invasion, and that right. will hit ourselves, and it's self-destructive for the West. But let me just say, there were lots of alternatives. There were also lots of alternatives for Ukraine that we could discuss if, as I said, we focused on what was the underlying conflict. But today, everybody's fighting on focusing on the war, and politicians are in this mad world of saying we're going to win. And if everybody says to win, you know, this is going to be a loss for everyone and for Europe and for the world.
Ray McGovern, let's pick up where Mr. Oberg just left off. The Finnish Prime Minister just recently, Sanna Marin, recently gave her opinion on the Ukraine conflict. She said the war in Ukraine has exposed European weaknesses and strategic mistakes in dealing with Russia. I want you to expand on what she meant for us.
Well, I hold no brief for that lady leader. I think she's naive in the extreme, but every now and then you can say something sensible, and she did so in this case. NATO is weak. For the head of U.S. intelligence to express optimism because Russia is running out of weapons and missiles and not realize that so is NATO, even worse, is a figment of, is a symptom of this overweening desire to work the West's will against Russia. Now, I have to tell you that this is a tectonic shift. The Ukrainian fracas has driven Russia into China's arms even more firmly than it was before. And we have Putin today talking about a multipolar world. That's true, but it can also be looked on as a bipolar world. It's the lily white West, of which Jan and I are both members, against people of color who happen to comprise 70% of the rest of the world, all right? You have China, India, you have Russia, really. You have Latin America, Iran, Saudi Arabia. Now, for God's sake, Russia has not been isolated. Russia has been driven into the arms of the East. Long story short, Putin has decided there's no good sense in dealing with the West. He's been deceived too often. And the most recent deception, which nobody knows about, was Biden's promise to Putin on the 30th of December that Washington has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine as they can be put in Poland and Romania. Now, what happened to that promise? Went through the cracks, never mentioned again, and was only in the middle of February this year where Putin said, look, I'm not going to deal with these people anymore. Went up to China, said, will you back me if I invade
Indeed.
Ukraine? And Xi said, you mean after the Winter Olympics are over, right? And he said, yeah. Now, this is big. China made an exception to its longstanding policy of Westphalia. They gave Putin a waiver on that, and they support him now. That is big, cannot be overestimated.
Okay, one last question for Mr. Oberg. We're short of time. The Russian president, he threatened to cut oil production in response to the Western price cap on the country's crude exports. Putin has slammed the price cap as, quote, a stupid decision, warning that the move is harmful to global energy markets. A guest that we spoke to actually earlier here said that the EU's price cap decision will come back to haunt the bloc itself. Do you see it in that light as well?
We can discuss, and I said I'm critical of this military invasion as a peace researcher and a pacifist, basically. But I think the response of NATO and the EU to it is extremely counterproductive, if not directly stupid. I would say it's made by kakistocrats. Kakistocracy is what we have. We don't have democracy anymore. It's people who, by knee-jerk reaction, installed the sanctions, prevented Russians from coming into, prevented concerts from taking place, canceled Russia as a European state and a piece of history and culture, instead of saying, okay, shit has happened, now what do we do to talk with each other? This was a big cover-up activity or policy to cover up for the fact that NATO has made its biggest blunder since 49 and ought to be closed down.
All right.
And what I'm saying is, and all discussions about this should stop, there are alternatives. It's time media and politicians and intellectuals begin to discuss possible futures for Europe where we have put the war behind us. We cannot live with a new Cold War, a canceled Russia from Europe the next 30, 40, 50 years. I refuse to believe that that is normal intelligence. And therefore, my point is, look for a negotiated solution before we all end up burning some kind of Armageddon.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're fresh out of time for this segment of the program. Allow me to thank my guests, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, joining us from Raleigh. Also, thanks to founder at transnational.life, Mr. Jan Oberg, joining us from Lund, Sweden. And also special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The Zionist regime's blockade on Gaza through land, sea, and air has badly affected the tiny enclave's residents. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, Kamel Arafat's family is in constant fear that something bad could happen to him. Relatives of the firefighter from the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza City have therefore decided to try to stay in constant touch with him during emergencies. It doesn't quite suit Arafat, 38, even if he appreciates the concern. It is better not to call. I've asked my family to calm down. They just can't. Their rights as well. What we go through is brutal, he said. The father of four has been an emergency responder for 15 years. He joined rescue crews during all recent major Israeli regime aggressions against Gaza, starting in 2008. He told the Electronic Intifada, every time I hear my phone ringing during escalations, I instantly understand it is work with a new emergency and probably more casualties. He answers such calls with mixed feelings. We throw ourselves into dangerous situations to rescue people from death, but we know we might be dead ourselves at any moment, he said. During Israeli regime offensives, Arafat works from early morning until late night to rescue people and their belongings, especially those buried under rubble. He sometimes does not return to his house for 4 or 5 or more consecutive nights, he says. Once we get a chance to rest before heading to a new task, we nap anywhere, anywhere, on any piece of cloth, on the sidewalk, in the car. Despite all the challenges, he said, they will continue to work. No matter the danger, every first responder will only work harder when they hear people crying for help from the rubble.
Thank you.
During challenging times, Arafat wants to be next to his children, aged between 6 and 12, and wife to reassure them. I sometimes hug them so hard before leaving home, a goodbye hug as if I might not return, he said. First responders usually carry traumatic memories around with them, Arafat has his share. The 2014 massacre, which the Zionist regime carried out in the Shajaya neighborhood of Gaza City, proved particularly harrowing. In 2014, we were able to enter Shajaya after the Zionist regime declared a humanitarian truce. The truce was violated immediately by the Israeli forces. The whole scene was awful. Many bodies were strewn on the ground. Some were fully burnt. They were also the bodies of animals. During the same assault, he still vividly remembers the aftermath of the Wahdan family massacre in the northern Gaza town Beit Hanun. The Zionist regime troops had kept the family inside and used their home as a military base. 12 people died there, and Arafat vividly remembers specifically how the women's bodies were burnt. I cannot forget at all. It was horrifying, he told the electronic Intifada, adding, we saw women besides their children, all dead under the rubble. I sometimes think of their last moments, what they were thinking of and how they felt. It is a bad ending. Like Arafat, Muhammad Abu Shokhfa worked throughout all the Zionist regime's wars on the Gaza Strip. He remembers them all simply as bloody conflicts filled with people in need of his help, except for 2014 when it got more personal and he lost two of his closest colleagues in front of his eyes. Abu Shokhfa, 34, and five of his colleagues had been called to Shajaya neighborhood and thought at first that the shelling had stopped. All of a sudden, a series of heavy explosive tank shells were fired directly at us. Our colleagues Rami Thahar and Ahad Doha were killed in front of my eyes, said Abu Shokhfa. He took a small pause to collect himself before he continued. It was a shock. I was in disbelief, Abu Shokhfa told the electronic Intifada. It was a huge loss for me. For Abu Shokhfa, the job is just that, a job. I have no difficulty rescuing people I don't know. But it was different with his colleagues. It was much harder, he said. We were six on that mission, only four came back. He had done his best to deal with the situation and continue working. But he concedes that I did not give myself enough time to process what he had just seen. There were other people to rescue, he said. Under pressure, I returned to reality and started to work again. With limited staff and equipment, Gaza Civil Defense sometimes calls on volunteers to assist in a rescue operation, like in the Wehda Street massacre in Gaza City last year, where residential buildings belonging to Abu al-Awf and al-Qawaliq families were bombed at nearly the same time. Abu Shokhfa said, calling more people to join us was important as the destruction was massive, and we needed to avoid a high rate of civilian casualties. It is the ever-present danger of Israeli regime aggression and the high price such aggression exacts that makes the work of first responders in Gaza so demanding and dangerous. After this, an Israeli-imposed siege on Gaza prevents necessary equipment from helping the civil defense forces modernize. Thus, Gaza's firefighters are unable to secure vital items like fire hoses, firefighter lights, or spears under the Zionist regime's so-called dual-use list of banned products. The poor resources available to Gaza's firefighters were briefly noted by Western media last month. The New York Times reported the first two fire trucks which reached the scene of a major fire in Jabalia refugee camp did not even have a ladder between them. That was despite how the building where the fire occurred had a number of floors. A total of 21 people were killed in the Jabalia fire. Better equipment could allow first responders in Gaza to save thousands of lives, Samir Al-Khatib, deputy director of Gaza Civil Defense, said. adding, "We have not been able to keep pace with developments abroad." In all, according to Al-Khatib, Gaza has between 450 and 500 emergency responders, including firefighters. First responders are supposed to be protected under the Geneva Conventions. However, according to Al-Khatib, 34 have been killed during the Zionist regime's aggressions against Gaza since 2008. "We have been targeted multiple times, even though we have always wear our uniforms. Our cars are known to the Israeli side," said Khatib. "But we cannot trust Israeli troops. We fear the treachery of the occupation forces."